Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media. I'm David McDougall, your host this week again, and joining the conversation, we've got my colleagues from the politics team, Adele Merson in Aberdeen and Dan O'Donoghue in London, with producer Chris Finn making all the technical magic happen behind the scenes. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hello.
At this point every week, we usually introduce Callum Ross to talk about the ongoing Alex Salmond saga, but this week he's missing in action because as we record this Stooshy episode, Callum is covering the scenes in Edinburgh as Mr. Salmond gives his evidence at the inquiry into the Scottish Government's botched handling of sexual harassment complaints against the former minister. Events at Holyrood on Friday have the potential to be explosive, with Mr. Salmond already alleging a plot by the SNP and Scottish Government to have him imprisoned. But up to this point, he's made a lot of headlines but not provided substantive evidence of his accusations. That might all change with Friday's testimony. And so you'll just have to check out our website for the very latest twists and turns on this story. But Adan and Adele, this has already bled over into other areas of politics this week. Even before Mr. Salmond gives his testimony, Adele, we saw the First Minister having to field questions about it at her coronavirus briefing. What did you make of all that?
There has been the odd week where a question has, you know, one question has been asked at the coronavirus briefing based on the Alex Salmond inquiry. But this week, I think I counted about five or six questions. It was almost half coronavirus, half the Alex Salmond inquiry. And I think, you know, others would agree that this is really the week that it has finally maybe seems to be cutting through more, potentially with the public, but also, you know, the national media are picking it up this week. And I think that's probably because the two kind of personalities at the center of it are finally appearing, Alex Salmond this afternoon, in the next hour, and also Nicola Sturgeon next week. So I think that finally people seem to have picked up an interest on it. But yeah, as you say, I think the fact it's dominating First Minister's questions, it was dominating the briefing, just shows that it's no longer a kind of side issue. It is more kind of moving into the mainstream again.
And at these briefings, she usually does try to stick to coronavirus topics because there's that, you know, she doesn't want to be open to the accusation that she's using it for political grandstanding. But, you know, when you're faced with a barrage of questions from journalists about it, whether or not this is supposed to be strictly a coronavirus briefing, she was quite forceful, I think, with her responses. No, she didn't mince her words. But then again, Mr. Salmond also hasn't been mincing his words this week.
Yeah, it does feel in previous weeks, you know, there's been less said in her response. She's more sort of readily shut down the questioning. I guess she was asked those questions. So as she said, you know, if she was to ignore the questions or not answer them, then she'd be accused of, you know, being tight-lipped and not responding. Whereas if she does answer, then I know she's been accused by some people of making that briefing political because of what she had said this week. So I guess in that sense, there's no way that she can win.
I saw also this week there was a poll carried by STV that showed a dip not only in support for independence, although it's, you know, the 22nd poll in a row where there has been support for independence, but it showed a falling level of support, perhaps. But it also, there was a poll also this week that indicated quite a sharp fall in personal popularity, down 16 points for the First Minister. And I do wonder if that's a result of sort of this ongoing drip, drip, drip of Salmond inquiry stuff that's just, you know, perhaps not casting the First Minister in a particularly positive light, and whether we are starting to see more of an effect with the public being aware of that now. We really don't know how it'll impact the elections that are coming up just in 7 weeks. We've seen a drop in the First Minister's popularity, which might or might not be connected to the ongoing inquiry. And it all depends on what Mr. Salmond says on Friday and then the First Minister says next Wednesday.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone would agree they're both very talented politicians. So it's probably going to be, you know, you're going to hear Alex Salmond this week and you're going to hear the First Minister next week, and it is probably going to be quite close and just depend on sort of where your allegiances potentially already lay in terms of who you think is most believable and most convincing.
And once again, it comes down to perhaps tribalism in Scottish politics. Adele, thanks very much. We'll check back in with you in a little bit. But Dan, there was some mischief making in Westminster this week as well around the whole subject of Alex Salmond, with Liam Fox suggesting the UK government should step in to somehow shore up failing democracy in Scotland. What was that all about?
Yes, indeed. Well, Liam Fox, a former minister, of course, he is a proud Scot, and he chose to use the House of Commons as a bit of a stage to wade into this Alex Salmond saga this week. He raised a point of order on the floor of the House, and he basically said that the kind of the whole debacle over the evidence being published of Salmond on the Holyrood website and then it being taken down on and redacted on advice of the Crown Office, he said it would be damning in a tin pot dictatorship. He said, but this has happened in part of the UK. And then, as you say, he kind of appealed to the Treasury bench asking what action could be taken to ensure the Scottish Government doesn't bring the whole of the United Kingdom into politics into disrepute. I mean, what he's getting at there, really, I mean, I think it's kind of been hinted at before, is that while obviously there's a Scottish Parliament and plenty of devolved powers and a First Minister and an elected government, the civil service in Scotland is still kind of a UK civil service, which is obviously right out of Whitehall. So there are still kind of a lot of levers that can be pulled, and people have called for an inquiry in the past into the actions of the civil service and how it's operating in Scotland. So I think that's what he was kind of picking up there. Now, obviously, with the former First Minister's evidence today and then expected Nicola Sturgeon's next week, you're probably going to see more shenanigans like this in the House of Commons, just to really kind of keep that the pot stirring. I mean, I don't think the Tories will miss a chance, really, to kind of try and inflict as much damage as possible as we go through the next couple of weeks.
But there is a serious point here, Dan, that detractors alleging that democracy is being undermined in Scotland somehow, that institutions are corrupt, the legal system is corrupt. And while it might be merrymaking, that's also something that, you know, the First Minister has said is sort of a dangerous allegation to make, a dangerous thing to be alluding to. Do you think that the Downing Street, that the Conservatives really believe that democracy is being undermined in Scotland, or is it all just political point scoring?
I think it's probably somewhere in the middle of that. I mean, I think for anyone watching the fallout this week of, you know, I mean, it's obviously the internal processes of the Parliament and the Crown Office and the workings between the two, and, you know, it may well come out in the fullness of time what actually happened there. I know the Lord Advocate was taking questions in Holyrood the other day on this, but a lot of people weren't satisfied with his answers. You know, it was quite amazing to see, you know, a whole tranche of evidence published. It was on the website for 12, 18 hours. And then, you know, free to download. Anyone could have gone on there, and many people did. You know, and then it was kind of taken offline, large parts of it redacted, and, you know, some parts of it, you know, the criticism has been that the warning from the Crown Office was that some parts of it risked kind of going against this contempt of court order, hence why the redactions were needed. I mean, obviously it would have been helpful to have those redactions before it was published, but there were certain, people could obviously compare the unredacted version with the redacted version, and there were certain passages that people said, well, you know, this has got nothing to do with the contempt of court order. You know, this has been redacted for political reasons. So that, I think that's obviously muddied the waters and led to these accusations that there's some kind of institutional failure in Scotland. But yeah, you're right. You know, it's a very dangerous game to start, you know, undermining the Crown Office and the rule of law and things like that. It's you know, not a thing that really should be done. You know, you're going to invite a lot of really bad consequences if you start doing things like that. So I don't know. I mean, as I say, I think it's probably somewhere in the middle, but politicians need to be very careful.
And we also should point out the difference between institutional failings and incompetent cock-ups.
Exactly, yeah.
They are two quite different things. Well, look, let's move on to subjects that are not about Mr. Salmond, but we'll have ongoing coverage, of course, leading up to and beyond the First Minister giving her evidence next Wednesday. This week, the Scottish Government has been charting a very cautious roadmap out of lockdown. And as First Minister Nicola Sturgeon found out, you can't appease all of the people all of the time. Adele is back again. It seemed like there were more complaints than compliments for the government's handling of their roadmap out of lockdown this week. I guess it was because they maybe didn't go quite as far as the Scottish, as the UK government went in naming dates when things would happen. You've been covering that. What was your sense of why they were being cautious this week? And their response to the backlash, maybe?
The First Minister's plan to exit lockdown, you know, it's been criticised as falling short of public expectations and lacking any clarity beyond the end of April. I think it didn't help that this announcement came just a day after the Prime Minister published his plans. And I guess the whole communication style of that was very different. It was, you know, referencing this June 21st date where in England most of the target is that most COVID-19 restrictions will be sort of abolished by then, whereas the First Minister came forward with her her plan just 24 hours later, and it felt a lot more, you know, she admitted it was a lot more cautious, it was a lot more about patience. And what was interesting, you know, in one of the briefings this week, that the First Minister said that if she had given a sort of end date, so, you know, kind of referencing the one in England of June 21st, that she would effectively be making it up, was what she said. So not saying she wasn't directly saying the Prime Minister was making it up, but that was kind of the insinuation that you would take from that, you know, she didn't know what evidence he was basing that off of, really. So she's going along the track of she doesn't want to give the public false assurance or pick sort of arbitrary dates as she sees it out of thin air. Whereas down south, they feel they have that clarity, but it's whether those dates actually become a reality. So it depends what sort of person you are. Do you want to be pleasantly surprised that you get more freedom earlier than you'd expected, or do you want to get more kind of optimism now and then find that you're disappointed later on? I guess it just depends what kind of person you are. But she's making the point that, you know, they kind of go in three week periods based on looking at the impact of the virus. So she just doesn't feel she has the confidence to go as far ahead as May, June, and tell us what will be the situation there. So that's why there's this much more incremental approach, I guess, in Scotland.
And I think then you end up becoming a hostage to fortune. If you're Boris Johnson, you've made this date of the 21st of June and it's not opening up by then, you know, you've set the expectations so high and then not been met. And Nicola Sturgeon ends up going the other way. She doesn't put dates on things. And so anytime that they do maybe open up a little bit faster, as we saw hints of just, you know, a day later, that she was saying maybe some rural areas could open up faster, it looks like she's backtracking. So there's an interesting political dynamic at stake here. The First Minister also has to be careful about when they're opening up things ahead of the election as well, because that is another piece of the puzzle that we're putting together here when we're talking about coming out of lockdown. It's knowing that the election is coming up as well as all the other parts of society that people are really pressuring her to open up.
Yeah, I mean, the Conservatives went along that line of saying that, you know, Ms Sturgeon was rattled by the reaction to her plans and that she was backtracking, because as you say, that the following day, just following the publication of her route map, she had another coronavirus briefing where, as you say, she said that instead of every area going immediately to level 3 at the end of April, it could be that some areas, and she referenced particularly rural communities, may go straight into level 2. So I think she definitely did pick up on the sort of public mood that people just wanted some more hope. They wanted to, so, you know, when you actually look at the two plans, Boris Johnson's plan and Nicola Sturgeon's plan, there are subtle differences. So in England, they are opening up certain, you know, non-essential retail and things like that, I think about two, three weeks earlier. But other than that, you know, the early stages, you know, March, April, they're not that different. But I think what was different was just, I guess, the way that they were communicated and the fact that Boris Johnson's plan went a little bit further.
And he got his in first, isn't it?
Yeah. I think for all the arguments about the two plans, if you actually look at them in detail, they aren't all that different, other than Boris Johnson's goes further in providing, I guess, the news that everyone wants to hear. That so, you know, she you know, it's not easy for what she did either, because it's quite, you know, I'm sure people love to tell the public what they want to hear, but whether they always need to hear that, if it's not based on evidence, then, you know, it is tougher to say, actually, that might not be the case. We might not get rid of all the restrictions in June. So it's just not an easy task.
And all of it's data driven. So we have to also see how the, you know, the vaccine rollout happens, how it impacts hospital numbers, pandemic figures, hopefully decreasing as the vaccine rollout continues as well.
The First Minister did say in coming up with her plan that really the biggest unanswered question is exactly what impact the vaccine is going to have on people in terms of catching and spreading the virus. So they do have early evidence that is positive, that it is having a positive impact in those areas, but really they just want more time to have that confidence. So schools began to go back, have younger years at primary schools, they have began to go back. And she said they will look at measures like that. So as they gradually release certain parts of society, they're going to see what impact that has in line with what impact the vaccine is having. And that's why, you know, there is just this kind of 3-week kind of incremental approach to things.
Adele, thanks very much. And turning now to Downing Street's union unit. Dan, it's been melting like a cornetto on a hot summer's day. Again, what is going wrong with Boris Johnson's efforts to save the union? Is it just a case of too many chefs and not enough cooks, perhaps?
Oh my word, you tell me, David, at this point.
No, you tell me, you're the expert. You're the actual expert on this, Dan.
It's kind of, to give a bit of background on this, you know, it really kind of, it, I suppose you'd have to go back to Theresa May, really. She kind of realised, you know, there was an issue with the union policy, and she set up this kind of Dunlop review to kind of look at how the UK government was working and what needed to change and all the rest of it. And when Boris Johnson's come into office, he kind of picked up where she started, and he kind of established this, as you say, this union unit that was initially headed by a special advisor whose name escapes me, but he lost his job quite quickly, as is fashionable with that unit. And then Luke Graham, a former Scottish Tory MP, was given the job. I mean, the unit's task really was to kind of come up with policy and kind of help iron out like a common strategy, really, to help the UK government deal with the SNP and to try and curtail their poll lead. You know, as we mentioned earlier in the podcast, you know, there's been 22 polls now showing majority support for independence. So, I mean, Luke Graham, as readers of our papers and websites will know, lost his job a couple of weeks ago. He reports that, you know, people were a little bit unhappy with his performance in the unit, that, you know, things weren't going the right way. We then saw this chap called Oliver Lewis brought in, who he was kind of the deputy to David Frost, who's the Brexit negotiator. Oliver Lewis was brought in to kind of, he's been described as Dominic Cummins' protege. He was going to kind of be a bit more aggressive. He would kind of, you know, take the gloves off of the SNP. That was the message that was being briefed out anyway. And then he left Downing Street very quickly. I mean, it's kind of blink and you'll miss it, really. He was there for a matter of days. He left, apparently with some internal feud with other aides over kind of who had more influence over the Prime Minister. And now where we are, to bring it right up to date, so the union unit is essentially been kind of merged into the Cabinet Office in this thing called the Union Directorate, which is basically civil service led. So it'll just be, you know, civil servants helping ministers, really. Less kind of politics, more just, you know, assisting ministers on which direction to take. And the direction will be kind of laid out by this new cabinet committee chaired by the Prime Minister. So it's called the Union Cabinet Committee. It'll be the Prime Minister, Michael Gove, Rishi Sunak, and then all the secretaries of state for Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, and they're going to meet, we're told, on a regular basis to formulate kind of policy ideas. They will then instruct this union directorate on how to implement those policy ideas, and it should all work very smoothly and nicely. But, you know, the history of this issue, if we're to look at it, I mean, as I say, I mean, you know, ask me in a couple of weeks and it'll probably have changed again, I imagine.
Well, just briefly, the one thing that has really intrigued me is the Prime Minister's fiancée's role in all of this, that it was suggested that she's the Union Unit assassin who's bumping off these, you know, pro-Dominic Cummings, anti-Boris Johnson, Carrie Simons, right? Simons.
Yeah.
How much of a role? Because I'm pretty sure Norma Major, for example, wasn't, you know, issuing staffing decisions about who should be hired and fired in Downing Street. Does Carrie really have all that power?
Well, it depends really who you ask. I mean, you know, it's one of those classic, you know, palace intrigue type issues. You know, you'll read some papers and they'll say, you know, oh, you know, she's kind of pulling the strings and, as you say, hiring and firing and all the rest of it. And then, you know, you talk to other people and they kind of describe it, you know, it's just quite sexist really, and say, you know, it's, you know, she is a young woman who's ambitious herself and she's got other interests. I mean, it's, you know, Boris in no way is being manipulated. I mean, I suppose people are saying stuff like this because Carrie herself was, you know, formerly very senior in Conservative headquarters, in the comms side of things. So, you know, previously she had a role in this kind of area. You know, and of course, you know, like anyone, you know, you will speak to your partner about issues, and I imagine they do have discussions about politics, but you know, at the end of the day, Boris Johnson is the Prime Minister and will decide what course of action to take. I think the reason why you've seen so much suggestion that she's at hand in maybe Oliver Lewis leaving is because I hesitate to go into this because I can imagine our listeners' eyes glazing over, but there's another guy called Henry Newman who is a special advisor who's kind of been brought in to assist on issues of the union, and he is meant to be pals with Carrie Simmons, and he and Oliver Lewis didn't get on. So that is hence where some of the rumours have come in that, you know, this is where she's at a hand, basically. But I don't know. I mean, I think that unit has been so chaotic, really, since its inception, really. I don't think it's down to Carrie. I think it's just, you know, there's so many people pulling in different directions. I think the two major influences in Downing Street really are kind of from Michael Gove's side, who wants to, you know, this term's been rolled out a lot over the last couple of years, and it's horrible, but he wants to love bomb Scotland.
Oh, nobody wants to be love bombed by Michael Gove.
Oh, God, yeah. he just wants to talk about the positives. He wants to, you know, this idea of show, not tell, just kind of invest and, you know, cutting ribbons, open projects, you know, don't argue with the SNP. And then there's another faction who are more of the kind of vote leave mentality, who say, no, we need to attack, you know, get a slogan on a bus, you know, that kind of strategy. And it's this warring between the two tribes. I think in Westminster, they basically don't know what to do. And all the while you see these polls keep coming out showing, you know, runaway support. So basically they need to pick a position and stick to it, and you know, at the moment that they don't seem to be doing that.
Well, Dan, we will be checking back in with you for all the palace intrigue from number 10. That's the most exciting part. That's all from the Stooshie this week. Thanks to Adele Merson, Dan O'Donoghue, and producer Chris Finn. Don't forget to listen, download, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and join us again next week to be better briefed. Bye for now.
The Stooshie is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you are better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, and The Evening Express work hard every day, online and in print, to bring you careful reporting and analysis to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, Westminster, and beyond. Subscribe to The Stooshie today, recommend us to friends and family, rate and review it if you have a moment, and let us know what you think of what we cover and how we cover it on Twitter and Facebook. We're Stooshie Scott on both. Be better briefed with The Stooshie from DC Thompson Media.